Ah, hi everyone, this is Brett. Did you know that throughout 2013 and 2014, between our podcast, video work, and bonus shows, School Sucks has produced an average of about 12 pieces of content a month? Wow. Another thing you didn't know is that recently our team of accountants has valued each piece of that content at 50 cents. Well, haven't they ever heard of the subjective theory of value, you ask? I don't know. I don't talk to them because they all live in India, you know, because of outsourcing. But as a result of these recent findings, our director of loss prevention has advised me to ask each one of you to go to schoolsucksproject.com and join our AV club for $6 a month, a figure arrived at, as I'm also told by the accountants, by a careful calculation of the product of 12 and 50 cents. And you know, I think they're right. Once you sign up, you'll get access to a ton of cool, unreleased, and behind-the-scenes stuff, but you will also be doing your part to help keep this show going and growing and to help this important message reach those who need it most. Poor people. And by poor people, of course, I mean high school and college students. So go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and sign up.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I think we got it. That's a wrap. You know, this music in the background, these guys actually became quite successful and lived quite comfortably with nothing more than completely inane lyrics. And you know, I think that's an interesting commentary on how the American public typically undervalues anything that's truly thought-provoking. Oh, wait. I love this part.
Most, if not all, libertarians view the government as the enemy of the people. It's written and spoken of as though it were some malevolent alien that has attached itself to our civilization, from whose tentacly clutches we must all constantly struggle to escape. But the thing is, a constitutional, democratically empowered government, like the one we have in the United States, doesn't have to be the enemy of the people. It can actually be the most powerful and effective tool of the people. Unfortunately, most politicians with libertarian leanings seem like they would rather sabotage the government than work to make it better and more effective, which is really shitty to those of us who agree with Abraham Lincoln on the whole of, by, and for the people thing.
And so we must conclude that we are not the government. The government is not us. The government does not in any accurate sense represent the majority of the people. But even if it did, even if 90% of the people decided to murder or enslave the other 10%, this would still be murder and slavery, and would not be voluntary suicide or enslavement on the part of the oppressed minority. Crime is crime. Aggression against rights is aggression, no matter how many citizens agree to the oppression. There is nothing sacrosanct about the majority. The lynch mob, too, is the majority in its own domain. But while, as in the lynch mob, the majority can become actively tyrannical and aggressive, the normal and continuing condition of the state is oligarchic rule. Rule by a coercive elite which has managed to gain control of the state machinery. There are two basic reasons for this. One is the inequality and division of labor inherent in the nature of man, which gives rise to an iron law of oligarchy in all of man's activities. And second is the parasitic nature of the state enterprise itself. We have said that the individualist is not an egalitarian. Part of the reason for this is the individualist's insight into the vast diversity and individuality within mankind. A diversity that has the chance to flower and expand as civilization and living standards progress. Individuals differ in ability and in interest, both within and between occupations. And hence, in all occupations and walks of life, whether it be steel production or the organization of a bridge club, leadership in the activity will inevitably be assumed by a relative handful of the most able and energetic, while the remaining majority will form themselves into rank-and-file followers. This truth applies to all activities, whether they are beneficial or malevolent, as in criminal organizations. A second basic reason for the oligarchic rule of the state is its parasitic nature, the fact that it lives coercively off the production of the citizenry. To be successful to its practitioners, the fruits of parasitic exploitation must be confined to a relative minority. Otherwise, a meaningless plunder of all by all would result in no gains for anyone. Nowhere has the coercive and parasitic nature of the state been more clearly limned than by the great late 19th century German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer pointed out that there are two and only two mutually exclusive means for man to obtain wealth. One, the method of production and voluntary exchange, the method of the free market, Oppenheimer termed the economic means. The other, the method of robbery by the use of violence, he called the political means. The political means is clearly parasitic, for it requires previous production for the exploiters to confiscate, and it subtracts from instead of adding to the total production in society. Oppenheimer then proceeded to define the state as the organization of the political means, the systematization of the predatory process over a given territorial area. In short, private crime is at best sporadic and uncertain. The parasitism is ephemeral, and the coercive parasitic lifeline can be cut at any time by the resistance of the victims. The state provides a legal, orderly, systematic channel for predation on the property of the producers. It makes certain, secure, and relatively peaceful the lifeline of the parasitic caste in society.
All right, so let's move on to number four.
It puts on airs. I'm an atheist, and I know as well as anyone that we can be some condescending bastards when we want to be. But let me tell you something. When it comes to intolerable smugness, an atheist has got nothing on a libertarian. Unless the atheist in question happens to be a libertarian, which is not uncommon. Look, the point is this. Many libertarian politicians and commentators like to cultivate this image of intellectual superiority for themselves and their political philosophies. Unlike, say, liberals or non-libertarian conservatives, a libertarian roots his ideals firmly in the soil of reason. Libertarians are not swayed by appeals to emotions. They care not for what is popular or fashionable or empathetic or humane or fair or... Look, you get the idea. The point is, they're above all that. Which brings me to the last stupid thing I'll mention about libertarianism.
Okay, that was a messy one. Now, I agree that there is maybe a sort of smugness with a lot of the communication of the philosophy of liberty. We're working on that, you know. So there are some of us who are committed to doing a better job. I haven't always been very competent in that respect myself. But an atheist has nothing on libertarians?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the smugness is really related to the personality perpetuating or explaining an idea. There are many humane and empathetic atheists that maybe came from a religious background that can understand the allure and the sort of illusions that people buy into that come with being invested emotionally into many of the concepts and ideas presented by religion. But then there are those people that find it so abhorrent and kind of have a sort of smugness and arrogance about how they could ever believe that in the first place. That, I mean, it really depends on the individual you talk about in either camp. And it can also be applied to a religious person. How many religious people can be very smug or arrogant? You know, we know God exists, or we know hell exists, or we know no God exists. I mean, it really comes down to the person there and the way they present these ideas and how sure they are. Oftentimes, though, at least atheists try to argue from evidence and reason, whereas a religious individual has to really argue from a priori standpoints that there something exists prior to you know, the reality and cause and effect and some of these other basic concepts. Also, the superiority and the relevancy of technology and the progression of science has given a sort of arrogance and smugness to the atheist camp, because they can point to something and say, look, through reason and through experimentation, we have been able to progress the world and, you know, impose our will instead of being subordinated to a will that we don't even know exists. But I think that's still, again, up to the individual. I mean, it can be that same way with someone who believes in government or doesn't believe in government. I think it's important to remain open, employ techniques maybe such as nonviolent communication. And I know there's a lot of misunderstanding around those ideas. I'm not necessarily supporting Marshall Rosenberg's interpretation of relativistic. You know, it's every idea is has potential or has some sort of validity to it. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's ways that we can analyze and break down the way people use language to try to get on a more even keel with them, the same page with them, so we aren't just constantly arguing back and forth and not getting at least on a similar term, so we can present our arguments or understand our definitions of the arguments we're presenting. Just try to use different rhetorical techniques to try to get on the same page, instead of just alienating people by using fallacies such as what he does here, accent, where he says that libertarians have nothing on atheists. That creates a sort of emotional turbulence in the individual, or just that it's a presupposition in the individual that might hear that, who's unwitting or unknowing of the fallacies, that kind of can manipulate them subconsciously, because you immediately kind of either fall onto the either or side, which is kind of the point here, divide and conquer. Nothing on atheism. Well, if you're someone who is against the state and you hear that, you become emotionally sort of riled up. But if you're someone who's for the state, you're like, or is an atheist and for the state, you kind of become, you know, very much agreeable with that. Just by the way he manipulated the language there creates a sort of emotional turbulence in the individual, depending on which way they lean, which is a great technique for divide and conquer. And that's just the way he used the word nothing. That alone, you know, creates subtle tendencies in the way we then rationalize what he said, one way or the other. It's very important to be aware of just how much we are emotional creatures. It works very well. This is what sophist rhetoric and technique is all about. It's sophistry 101.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because even when you bring critical eyes and ears to this presentation, I think there's still times for many of us where we're like, wait a minute, what just happened? You know, because of, you know, some tactic that he employs, deliberate or just out of habit. He could simply be mimicking a presentation style he saw somewhere else, doing very little research on the subjects that he wants to criticize. And I'm sure it varies. He does a bunch of these five stupid things videos. So I'm sure some of the topics that he covers, he knows a lot about. This is not one of those examples for sure. But because of that, wait a minute, what experience? I do want to go back, because I think there's a little bit more there to tease out.
Anyone, that we can be some condescending bastards when we want to be. But let me tell you something. When it comes to intolerable smugness, an atheist has got nothing on a libertarian. Unless the atheist in question happens to be a libertarian, which is not uncommon. Look, the point is this. Many libertarian politicians and commentators like to cultivate this image of intellectual superiority for themselves and their political philosophies. Unlike, say, liberals or non-libertarian conservatives.
Okay. Unlike, say, liberals? You know, I mean, here's what I think is arrogant, is to say to millions of people that you've never met, hey, strangers, my ideas are so good that I'm justified carrying them out by the use of force or the threat of force against you, the threat of violence, really, to be clear, right? That's right. Pretty arrogant.
I think it goes back again to what I was saying earlier, that he's oversimplifying, again, all these different abstractions, liberals, conservatives. He uses all this different terminology to describe these varying political ideologies that he's so sure that they either have or do not have a certain level of arrogance or smugness, which it really depends on the person who espouses that ideology. It depends on the demeanor, the intellectual depth and empathy, the emotional intelligence within that individual and life experience. What we're neglecting here, I'd actually like to, because I don't even have this in my notes, but I just thought of it now. There's composition and division. One, I think composition, you go from the part to the whole, which what if you say about the part applies to the whole, which isn't always true. In this case, mm-hmm. what he's saying of the whole, that there's all these different political ideologies out there, applies to each part or each person that adheres to these different political ideologies. And that's absolutely not true. And whether it's political ideologies, philosophical ideologies, or religious ideologies, which I really mentioned, and it's all the same. It really comes down to the individual and their capacity for rhetoric, the different techniques they might employ, the different life experiences they have with interacting with different people and different ideas, whether they're open-minded and have a dialectical discourse or whether they're very closed off. There's just so many variables here that it almost drives me nuts that he would essentially employ a fallacy, a simplifying fallacy here, that everything falls. But notice he's been doing this consistently, actually, now that I think about it. You know, there's this government. The government does these special things, or, you know, there's these different political ideologies, and everyone under these different political ideologies tends to all have similar personalities in the way they interact with human beings, which that's the division fallacy. Taking the part, taking this whole thing, this whole ideology, and applying it to every person, it's just ridiculous. And the way they act is really what he's saying in this case. I just think that's for him, what you said, Brett, for him to have such an arrogance and such a sort of violent perspective that he's so right about this. He's so correct. He's figured it all out. And this is exact, but people can fall under these very overly simplified categories. And this is the way they act. But somehow libertarians act way more than this. And this is that hyperbole, that exaggeration with language, the accent fallacy with language. My God, I mean, we can just find no wonder. I mean, did we allow him to troll us, or were we just like, man, it's just so yes. bad?
It could have been a combination of both. I think at the end, because we were 3.5 hours into it, I was like sweating. It was warmer when we recorded that show. We were both like quite right. exasperated and frustrated. And I think at the end we declared him the winner. I think he would have listened to the first take of this show and just been so satisfied with himself, for what he had done to us. It would have made his weekend for sure.
I do feel like we're a bit more calm in this presentation.
Yes, yes.
Than the following one.
But you're right.
Rather, we did before.
So. There is so much to go through here. It's amazing. And in this number four, Libertarianism Puts on Airs, there's actually one more coming.
Libertarian roots his ideals firmly in the soil of reason. Libertarians are not swayed by appeals to emotions. They care not for what is popular or fashionable.
Okay, now this is interesting. He builds this momentum by complimenting libertarians on not engaging in fallacies.
Using human reason. Isn't that what he said? I think it's like, they try to use like evidence or reason. I think he said something like that.
Right. So he says, what are the fallacies that he just mentioned libertarians don't do? They don't do the appeal to emotion, or they don't fall for the appeal to emotion. They don't do the appeal to tradition. They don't do the appeal to popularity. So this sounds complimentary, but then with that momentum, which again is rhetorical, he just turns on a dime and does this.
Or empathetic, or humane, or fair, or look, you get the idea. The point.
I mean, what happened? I thought I was getting a compliment. Hold on, let me just go back and play that whole part again.
A libertarian roots his ideals firmly in the soil of reason. Libertarians are not swayed by appeals to emotions. They care not for what is popular or fashionable, or empathetic, or humane, or fair, or. Look, you get the idea. The point is, they're above all that. Which brings me to the last stupid thing I'll mention about libertarianism.
Yeah, so...
Oh, boy. First of all, there's an ad hominem here we're not mentioning. And ad hominems are some of the most common fallacies, but the fact he's just attacking individuals really that espouse or adhere to libertarianism as a political or just a philosophical ideology. Mm-hmm. So right there, just the fact that he attacks individuals for this idea and the way he presents it. I mean, he attacks it. We did mention one before, the U2 fallacy, like we mentioned in the first one. There's also the genetic fallacy, the idea that he attacks certain psychological origins, you know, that you know, we have this sort of a selfish psychological foundation to why we espouse this ideology. Really? You know, that's an ad hominem. It's a modality of ad hominem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, he also, you know, he attacks the trustworthiness, which is poisoning the well of the person making the statement or all any in libertarians making statements, essentially in a way he does it here by saying, he attacks the idea that they might be empathetic or humane. There's another fallacy that applies here. I can't remember the name, but it's essentially like slipping in something at the end of an argument.
That's the irrelevant conclusion.
Or ignorance of the chain. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Okay, great.
Yeah, so I mean, what you're saying, as long as I'm understanding you correctly, it's to, again, using a kind of a momentum of what we could call facts, you know, or terms, terms or statements that are easy to agree with, and then saying, therefore, we need more funding for the teachers union. You know,
right.
I mean, that would
in
be
his
an irrelevant
conclusion. Right. From the premises he states, he adds in his conclusion all these different ideas or concepts that don't actually apply to what libertarianism is. So first he says, oh, you know, they're above fallacious rhetoric, appeals to emotion, appeals to popular thinking. But all then he sneaks in other aspects to the conclusion that he's, you know, therefore also or empathetic or humane or, you know, these other concepts that don't necessarily apply to libertarianism. That's up to the individual, whether they're empathetic or humane, but it has nothing to do about the actual philosophy or ideology of libertarianism.
You know, Tony, that's actually a tricky one because it sounds like in his presentation that he's just giving a list, but that's the turning on the dime that he does, right? It sounds like he's continuing a list, but what it actually is you're right. It is kind of an irrelevant conclusion because suddenly he's making the point that he wants to make out of that list. He's saying, because libertarians are this, this, and this, libertarianism is this. Right?
Exactly.
It happens
right.
very
he
quickly.
Sneaks it in the conclusion out of nowhere, very subtly, very quickly. And then as the listeners or the people in your audience will hear, it goes right on to number five. And that's what's kind of scary about the way he presents this, because first of all, he has his own smugness. And we already mentioned in his disposition the way he presents himself. But then all of a sudden he presents this irrelevant conclusion where he sneaks in these other properties that have nothing to do with libertarianism at all in the conclusion and are completely disconnected from the premises and the other arguments or the evidence he brought up to, you know, bolster those premises, which like what libertarianism is, the fact that it's reasonable and it tries to ignore appeals to emotion and, you know, different fallacies of, you know, appeal to popularity, appeal to, you know, all those different appeal fallacies. It tries to ignore all those, but then it also, he sneaks in these other concepts that has nothing to do with it. Because really what he's arguing is that libertarianism uses human reason. That's what he's saying. And then by using human reason, it ignores certain, you know, fallacies that people employ to trick people, to use people, to get people to buy into certain ideas or ways of life, or ways of thinking, and so forth and so on. But then it also does this too.
Mm. Well,
and then on to the next point.
It goes back to a euphemism that he used earlier, social. People who don't support government are antisocial. Government is social. So helping people, all of these things, social. But because libertarians don't engage in what's popular or they don't fall for appeals to emotion, they're anti-government, they're anti-social. That, I mean, it's not direct, but it seems like that list that he gives is built off the same idea that he presented earlier.
But then it gets into, we can talk about it. He oversimplifies and creates, you know, we didn't talk about this fallacy, but what's it called? It's generalization fallacies.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of probably an oversimplification. I kind of touched upon the ideas where in division, where he has this general category when I mentioned the different political ideologies and how people act underneath that. It's this idea that in his oversimplification of these arguments and these concepts, he creates these very generalized ideas that don't actually represent anything universal. They just represent a sort of improper reasoning on his own part about what this actual generality represents. And, you know, that's when I think part of it's we think about government, he generalizes government to be this certain thing. He generalizes society to be this certain thing. And it's much more complex. He's not really abstracting the characteristic that makes it truly unique, that universal, that essence. He's creating his own artificial generalization that doesn't actually apply to the whole, that isn't proper, that is not universal, cannot be said about everyone within this generalization he's creating, whether it's a political ideology or whether it's the way human beings act if they're part of a certain idea or concept or movement. It's just, and that would be a fallacy of oversimplification, really. Mm-hmm. Just to these ridiculous overgeneralizations and lacking context, lacking detail. There's no subtlety, which creates a lot of the fallacies of argumentation, like the black and white fallacy, the either or fallacy, and irrelevant conclusions. So you can see, we can go from a fallacy of language, just the way he uses language, to oversimplification of concepts, then get used in these arguments. And what we see is, again, this cascading effect I mentioned in the beginning. This is a sort of theme with the way fallacies go. It starts with the domino just hitting one or a couple dominoes, and then the whole thing just, you know, spreads out from there. We can find fallacies in all these different categories.
Right.
Well, oftentimes, it's very much accidental. It's just sometimes laziness and the argumentation. We all do it. But, you know, in this case, just the way he sat down and did a polished production, obviously, this has a bit more than just an accidental quality to it. So.
Yeah. Couple of notes here. Great. You know, we've done series on productivity, and part of productivity is time management. A way to decide how much time you want to invest debating somebody is what do their definitions look like, you know, and will they accept your efforts to clarify definitions before a real debate even begins, right? Can you effectively restate their argument in a way that makes sense to you? If that bridge, if that rift is too wide for the bridge to be built, forget about it. You know, watch football, have some appetizers, depending on, you know, wherever you're at, you know, but
that's a great point. Yeah. I really appreciate you tying that into productivity, time management, and just how to know how to utilize your time, especially when hearing individuals that are using language purposefully, most likely fallaciously. And once you analyze this, what's your value here? What actions do you, you know, ascertain to bolster those values you have? So if you don't want to waste your time and have more meaningful, productive things you could do, and you're kind of just hearing these different arguments that you know you have nothing to, that adds nothing or any quality to your own life, you know, that's where if you can change your habits, go do something else. Do something more productive. And productive can mean something more for yourself that might just be pure entertainment. It might just be letting go and having a little bit of fun, relaxing, or it could be, you know, actually doing some work or a project or whatever. I'm really glad that's a wonderful segue, although I guess I can't call it a segue, but at least an association here to production time management. That's a great point to bring up, Brett. I really appreciate that.
But you're in luck because it is a segue to my second note.
Great. Perfect.
Supporters of Steve Shives might say we're being a little unfair here because this is a 5-minute video. And to his credit, he has packed a tremendous amount of opinion into 5 minutes. But to say that there's argumentation errors that result from black and white thinking, that might just be, we could sit down with him for maybe 3 hours, the two of us over coffee, and have, a very enriching and stimulating conversation, but that's not going to come through in a 5-minute video. The reason why I chose this video is because I have had conversations with people who have similar worldviews to Steve Shives, conversations that lasted 3 hours, you know? That had no more nuance than this video does, right? So that's why I thought this video was a good representation, condensed representation of common criticisms or objections to the philosophy of liberty. So it's a lot packed into a little, but I've certainly had 3-hour conversations that featured you know, an opponent who provided no more detail than he's provided, with a lot of the same black and white thinking that he's exhibiting.
So have I. That's a great point. And it's multidimensional in that aspect because it's a very easy video to pick on just because of the way he presents these arguments. And the video is short, concise, and it's purposefully a bit over the top. If people can't catch that just in the way he uses language, it's quite obvious. But not only is it that, which makes it very easy to analyze fallacies, if you're just trying to teach someone how to use how people use fallacious rhetoric and how to analyze certain fallacies, especially in this context. But then it's also as a multidimensional effect, we're tackling another subject that I agree 100%. I've had many conversations with many individuals that espouse the same ideas of government, of authority, the same loose definitions of libertarianism, and it lasted hours, if not, for over decades for some of my friends. There's very much embedded within, the idea of statism being a necessity. And, I wouldn't say wasting many conversations, but just not evolve. The conversations never evolve beyond the same talking points that we've had since high school.
Right.
It's like the thinking, the definitions, the properties and makeup, the definitions, the evidence, the philosophy underlying any of these things never evolve. It's just the same talking points. So he presents these talking points that seem to be universal to the way really the mass media, I call a portrayal of these ideas.
Right.
And what many people within our culture and society view all these different ideologies as being.
So, Tony, we're certainly aware of a lot of problems here, but maybe he brings it all together in number 5 in a big, spectacular finish. What do you think?
Oh, it might be a synthesis. Let's see. Problem, reaction, solution. Yeah.
All right, here we go in number 5.
It's naive. Yes, besides being outdated and buffoonishly pompous,
Okay, first of all, I just want to point out for our audio listeners that there is a graphic on the screen right now, robber barons.
Robber barons, I thought so. Yeah.
So, oh my God. It's a meme. At the top, it says robber barons. At the bottom, it says historical proof that libertarianism is full of shit. And we will come back to that.
Libertarianism is also inescapably naive, since it assumes that, given maximum personal and economic freedom, individuals would just sort of work out an ideal or at least improved society for themselves. Never mind that democratic government represents an attempt to do exactly that sort of thing. Suppose not everyone in this minimally governed free market society was all that ethical. Suppose, and I know this is hard to imagine, but bear with me, that those with the most wealth and resources decided that their private interests were more important than those of other individuals or of society as a whole.
Now, I'm going to pause there because a lot of people are listening and saying, isn't he describing what already exists in his dystopian vision of libertarianism?
I was just going to say about... doesn't the government do all those same things?
He's going to address that, though. So more thought going into number 5.
Libertarians will often caricature government in exactly this way.
Caricature government in exactly that way. Mm. Interesting choice of words.
Describing it as the powerful living off of the powerless with no concern for the welfare of those they exploit. And yet, the alternative that libertarians propose to this, which in their bitterness over having been born as members of a social species they perceive as tyranny at the hands of government, is something that amounts to tyranny at the hands of unaccountable magnates. Minimum government, maximum freedom, to those who can afford it.
Okay.
God.
That's it. Now.
Scary.
There's a big problem there. Isn't there, right? Now, first of all, to deal with the naivete of
those big problems, the whole thing is just wrought with errors. But no, go for it.
Yeah, it's like it's such a mind mess. At the end of each one of these, it's kind of hard to decide where to start. But with the central point of number 5, that it's naive. And like I've said before, yes, in a world that we've inherited from complete insanity and slavery and the subjugation of all kinds of people and violence as the first answer.
Violence, abuse, yeah, right. Yeah.
Of course, yes. In that world, libertarianism is incredibly naive. So it's such a mischaracterization, such an important mischaracterization to say libertarianism, the philosophy of liberty, is about going back. going back to what? Like, I'm only interested in going forward, you know, for me personally. And I see, like, the libertarian communities that I've been involved in, people very focused on the future and new technological developments and how they can contribute to more freedom. I have never seen anyone with a tri-cornered hat and a musket. Never seen it. That's not my crowd, right? So that's so important, this distinction between looking forward and looking backward. That's the biggest misdirection, one of the biggest misdirections anyway, in this whole video, that libertarianism looks backward. We're looking forward to outgrowing this world of insanity, I think, more than anything.
The anachronistic theme is consistent, isn't it? He may not be bringing it up all over the place, but point three seems to be a consistent theme throughout each point he makes in all five of them. It's a good.
Let's bring up another example of why I thought it might be useful to refer to the series from this point on as the Trivium Saves Lives, and this graphic of the robber barons, where it says proof that libertarianism does not work. Steve, did you do your homework on these people? I mean, you could talk about this for hours, Tony, about how these are the people who used the state, you know? Beyond just the education system that we've talked – or schooling system, excuse me, that we've talked about in such detail on this show and on Peace Revolution.
Big business loves big government. That never fails. They're also the ones who set up tax-free foundations. Many of these people who had tons of finance capital, which there's a key distinction between finance and industrial capital. They didn't even make their money – or at least for, as an example, Rockefeller, in a way that most people think they would by just the standard monopoly. He went in, had, you know, bought up a bunch of different, oil refineries and just, you know, was able to undercut prices. It's actually much more complex. He controlled the supply line and the speculation associated with it. That's where he started to make his fortune. It wasn't the hardworking engineers that started to pull their capital together to try to develop, the industry in a different way and to use the capital in a different way, because the way these individuals ended up using the capital was to enforce more government regulation to actually bolster up these individuals and their businesses and then create tax-free foundations to essentially impose their will subtly through social engineering techniques, citizenship ideas, assembly line progressive mentality to get rid of the idea of an educated populace and in turn put more of a worker assembly line sort of a person in place of the sort of classical think for yourself mentality, the idea of logic and reason. And these individuals are ones who perpetuated this sort of progressive system. Ironically, they piggybacked on government in order to provide or coerce that sort of system onto the populace,
right,
through government regulation. Also, many of them used much of their finance to manipulate the creation of the Federal Reserve, the various banks and investment companies that they were able to set up and influence certain universities. And they had a certain ideology of progressivism, which related to more of this up and coming trend of scientism, the power of the assembly line. It's a whole movement here. I think your series with Thaddeus Russell kind of touched on it. Maybe not these individuals particularly, more of the societal implication and impact it had. It was a whole ideological movement that was being undertaken around the turn of the century, going into the industrial model or way of living. And these individuals were paramount to not only changing public perception, public habits, education, but really employing many science and universities through tax-exempt foundations to really engineer the sort of society they dreamed of, to create the sort of I don't want to say the word control necessarily, but certainly have the influence that would perpetuate their own prosperity moving forward. And I'm not giving credence here to Steve Shives at all, because this is actually piggybacking on the public domain we call government to enforce this privatization, this monopoly or oligarchy. And I would really call it finance capital, just the ability to manipulate money itself and the supply of money, and how that relates to these industries that were so key to the industrialization movement at the end of the 19th and beginning of the early 20th centuries, such as Harriman with the railroads, Rockefeller with Standard Oil, and how they really manipulated, you know, key business ethics that others were trying to practice, and using government to really reinforce their own will. So there's such an irony here.
Yeah. Right?
What do you say at the end? It's like the most liberty for those who can afford it or something, you know?
Yeah.
That's not the truth. They used the government to reinforce that.
Really, like when this graphic came up, I was convinced the first time I saw this video that I had been the victim of somebody's practical joke, you know, because this was the proof of the dangers of the state. So not doing the grammar of who are the robber barons? When did they exist? What did they do? How and where did they get their power? Just asking those questions, if he had done it or if we do it, it can launch us into this whole historiographical discussion about the origin and the intention of that term itself, right? And its staying power in like college textbooks of today. We could learn a tremendous amount if it had been, you know, that graphic had been expanded into some discussion. I put in my notes just a paragraph from a Thomas DeLorenzo article from Mises.
Oh, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah. Glad. Go ahead.
Yeah.
That's great.
This is just an excerpt. As common as it is to speak of robber barons, most who use that term are confused about the role of capitalism in the American economy and fail to make an important distinction, the distinction between what might be called a market entrepreneur and a political entrepreneur. A pure market entrepreneur or capitalist succeeds financially by selling a newer, better, or less expensive product on the free market without any government subsidies, direct or indirect. The key to his success as a capitalist is his ability to please the consumer. For in a capitalist society, the consumer ultimately calls the economic shots. By contrast, a political entrepreneur succeeds primarily by influencing government to subsidize his business or industry, or to enact legislation or regulation that harms his competitors. Now, there's something else interesting. This is a point that I brought up with Thaddeus Russell, and he balked at it a little bit, but acknowledged that there was something there. If you are successful with your political influence, say through the school system, you don't really need to put that much thought into, am I a political or market entrepreneur? Because if the market is dictated by the wants of consumers, if you've kind of stripped out the critical thinking capacity of consumers, you've got less to think about as a producer. And this was the point I brought up. Does people's schooling interfere with this demand? You know, and I think there's something, I mean, like we want to have faith in free markets, right? But how much has schooling affected what we call the free market? I think that's important. I think that's just an important thing to point out there. It's a little off topic.
I feel like the free market even today is a loaded term, just like capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
When both, if you actually define them, are quite innocuous, especially the free market, but even capitalism is a very innocuous definition. When you look at individuals pooling their money or their capital together to create a venture to provide a consumer need or want. A very simple, very straightforward definition is not, but today it has underlying connotations, negative underlying connotations that are quite damaging to not only the concept, but the way people perceive or the sort of perceptions or ideas that populate individuals' minds when they actually hear it, let's say just on the radio or watching it on TV when someone says the capitalists or the capitalism or the way, you know, communist groups might use it. Or the way social democrats or very liberal individuals might use the word capitalism, it already comes loaded with all these negative connotations about, well, it instantly means that super rich are going to impose their will over the poor. And, you know, I always just go back to the sort of Marx angles like proletariat, you know, overcoming the bourgeois, and just the idea of like, you know, the worker class rebellion. There's like these terrible, and it's such an oversimplification again of these ideas. And the oversimplification comes from, again, it's just a lack of definition. What do these ideas really mean? Ironically, I think the Austrian school did a great job hashing out the main philosophical issues. The key distinct philosophical issues surrounding it is who enforces contract law between two parties. and what medium of exchange are we going to use in order to have some sort of exchange between each party? And, you know, who then enforces that? These key fundamental questions, which seem so simple, really arise into why we have the sort of government state we have today and the sort of government violence we have today. Because what are people doing? And I feel like Steve Scheiser mentioned it earlier, does this idea of this prescriptive, well, we need to go to this nebulous idea or this abstract concept called government, lobby it to create a new law to enforce through violence individuals to adhere to this new law because we need a change.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's just this constant sort of lack of understanding of what are we really doing fundamentally is like, who's going to enforce anything between two parties? You know, again, you have to think about the aristocrats and the inability to be able to work with the king in the 17th, 18th century. And the idea was, well, we'll set up a court system.
Yeah.
You know, we'll set up this, you know, we'll set up this Magna Carta. But then there's all these wars out of the Magna Carta. And, you know, that was like the 13th century or something, you know. And then because the kings are like, well, we'll set up this thing, but we're not going to adhere to it because we don't really want to have to deal even with the nobles, you know, whatever. But then a bunch of wars are fought and like, well, this is too much work. Why don't we just have a system set up where we both can at least present our arguments and see and try to a dispute resolution organization. And, you know, that's evolved into the modern day court system, you know, that has very, you know, the civil law, criminal law, common law, statutory law, yada, 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 very complex. But, you know, these origins are really from like, who enforces me to do anything at all? You know, that's as simple as that sounds. Look at how crazy and how complex the system has evolved into just from the idea of how do we make people do certain things, or how do we enforce contract law? How do we barter or exchange goods between individuals? And I think the Austrian school has really hashed out those simplistic yet fundamental key concepts to the way in which we derive and develop manifest society.
Right. So we are 2 hours into raw unedited audio here, and I am ready to declare us the winners this time.
You think so? You didn't troll us this time?
No, I think we maintained our composure. We held it together. And of course, he forfeits. I did invite him on School Sucks, not for this purpose specifically, but okay. I did not hear back from him. So we're going to call that a forfeit. When one party forfeits, the other party wins, you know. I think that went much better. I think we provided good information regarding the fallacies and also filling in some of the historical context that he missed. And I'm energized for our next installment of this series.
Yeah, absolutely. I love doing this with you, Brad. You have a great show. I love this series. This is obviously what I'm into and what I helped out with Tragedy and Hope, not only with the productivity series, but this is really my main focus, the Trivium. And I hope individuals gain something out of it. And again, for those listening, it's really just a brief and very simple analysis of the way you can apply fallacies to language and arguments. And moving forward, maybe we'll tackle some more. See, a bit more complex.
Higher hanging fruit?
Yeah. Higher hanging fruit, certainly. We'll have to climb the tree a little bit this time and try not to cut ourselves on the way up or fall down. And I, you know, this is just a good introduction, I think, for individuals. And for those individuals that are interested, there's a host of fallacies we already mentioned in all the other previous points. And really the biggest fallacy here is, or one of the themes that have been consistent between all the distinctions, this is the idea of neglected aspect and the lack of definition.
Right.
Doesn't really understand history and context, and he doesn't understand how to properly utilize and create a definition that you use consistently in argumentation. And from that, we've analyzed and showed how it really is a domino effect with all the fallacies. And then so I encourage your audience, if they're a little bit, if they're interested in, to kind of test themselves out, or even maybe post some comments about it, just take point number 5, because we really just went into more of the historical inaccuracy and the lack of context. We didn't specifically name any of the fallacies, but just take a list of fallacies and see how many you can find within point number 5, and, you know, post them or on Facebook or the website. I think it's just a really simple, good test. You can do it with the other videos he has as well. From there, we'll progress forward and try to take on more complex argumentation.
Yeah. The
definitions are much more consistent, and it will take a little bit more to hash out.
Yeah, that's great. Like Steve Scheibes, and again, some of his work is very good, and some of it is quite astute, and there are some topics where he has certainly a fair amount of knowledge. Go to his channel. Find all his videos are nice and short. Find some Five Stupid Things videos that you think you would experience frustration, disagreement, and watch those and go through the same exercise. That's actually a great idea. This is a good warm-up routine.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really a great introduction to how you can apply some basic fallacies to language and argumentation. Then moving forward, we'll try to build upon this to show, you know, how much more complex it can become. I think this is a great beginning or a great primer episode, mainly because it really focuses on some of the rhetorical and sophisticated rhetorical techniques he used that kind of get us subconsciously emotionally manipulated. And because he really focuses on language, he doesn't really define anything, but this is his presentation. This is a great video to outline distinctions of how sophists would act and how they would use language. So sophisticated rhetoric is really about the fallacies of language, accent, slogan, hyperbole, exaggeration, you know, these sorts of fallacious rhetoric. And although we found that we could find a ton of other fallacies than we have in argumentation and oversimplification, I think that the one of the key and what makes this so interesting is just the way he actually presented the rhetoric itself, the language itself. And I think that's why it's a great primer episode. You'd see this a lot on mainstream media and the mainstream news outlets. You'll see the sort of like fallacies of language first and foremost. The definitions are quite often not consistent on mainstream media, but just the way they use language and get us emotionally invested and some of the ideas being presented, be conscious of that. Be conscious of your subconscious motivations and how some little word or the way it's presented, the way accented, the way it's exaggerated, the concept, how does that make you feel? What are your initial perceptions and how does that change the way you would like to answer back to an individual or that person? I just think being so conscious of these details is really important because all of a sudden you're going to learn, at least for myself, as an example, I learn over time to maintain more patience and a sort of calm demeanor and disposition.